Hi, here we are again. Welcome to another episode of Tales from the Doghouse, Separation Anxiety Explained. You're listening to me, Sarah McLaren from the UK, from Separation Anxiety Solutions. And with me is the wonderful Ness.
Hello, I'm Ness Jones. I'm in Australia and I am from Separation Anxiety in Dogs Decoded.
And I am Stacey Bell in the US with Focused Fun. Today, we have a super, super special guest today that I am very excited about and that I was teasing you guys about last week. And she is Zazie Todd, the creator of Companion Animal Psychology and author of the book WAG. Zazie, why don't you introduce yourself so I don't miss any of the important stuff?
Hi, thank you very much for inviting me to come and chat with you. I think you said the most important stuff. So I'm author of WAG, and I also have another book called Purr, The Science of Making Your Cat Happy, which is coming out in May. And that's like the sister book to WAG for the cat people. And I write Companion Animal Psychology and the Positive Post newsletter as well.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into your field?
Yeah, so I came to dogs rather late in life. I originally was a social psychologist in the UK, so an academic social psychologist. My PhD is in psychology. And there was a long time when I really wanted a dog. As a kid, I was terrified of dogs, but luckily I got over that and learned that dogs can actually be friends after all. And I spent years wanting a dog, but I was always at work or I was traveling, and my husband traveled a lot for work, and it wouldn't have been a good home for a dog. And then after we moved to Canada, all of a sudden we had, you know, the space and the time to get a dog, and we ended up with two dogs, Ghost and Bodger, both of whom I write about in the book. And that really was the start of getting interested in companion animal behavior and science, because I used to look at things about dog training. Bearing in mind my background as a psychologist, all psychologists do some animal behavior as part of their training, like learning theory and so on. And I also had occasionally taught bits of animal behavior to students, even though I specialized in social psychology. And so I would look at things that I saw on TV, not mentioning any names, and I would think, this does not fit with what I know. This does not make sense to me. And so I started to look to see what science told us about dogs and cats, because I've always been a cat person as well. And what I found was that it's absolutely fascinating, and that the field of canine science really had taken off. And so back in 2012, 10 years ago, I started writing Companion Animal Psychology. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know at that time that it was going to turn into all of this and two books and so on. So that's been incredibly lucky. But I just started because I thought, this is really fascinating. I bet there are other people who would like to know about this scientific research. And I bet there are other people who would like to know more about using positive reinforcement in training instead of some of these other not very pleasant methods that I saw people using and even talking about on telly. So that's really how I got into this. And I was very lucky to get a scholarship to the Academy for Dog Trainers, Jean Donaldson's course. So that was fantastic. And also I did a certificate of feline behavior with International Cat Care as well. And that was really fascinating too. And so really it's all come from that, though. It's come from that realization that there was so much happening in canine science. And kind of, if I could have gone back in time, when I did my PhD, it was on the psychology of language. And if I'd have wanted to do a PhD on animal stuff, then I could not have done it on cats. I kind of wished at the time that I could have done it on cats. And occasionally over the years, I did have students do things on pets, but at that time, psychologists were interested in rats and mice and pigeons. I could have done a PhD on pecking behavior in pigeons, but I didn't really, I didn't see the link. I was much more interested in people's behavior. But as you know, I mean, a lot of talking to people about dogs and cats is also influencing how people behave and looking at how people behave and helping them make habits and so on. So it's all still very relevant.
So I have a question. So when I meet a psychologist in a social situation, I'm looking at them going, are they psychoanalyzing me? You know, like, are they, we're just having this casual social conversation, but are they looking at me going, are you kind of, when you see a dog in the street or somebody walking down the street with a dog, are you like, oh, like, are you kind of looking at things constantly or?
Not really, but you know, that's funny because it is a question people sometimes ask when they find out your background is psychology. They're like, can you tell what I'm thinking? And just occasionally I've teased someone and said yes, and they've looked at me like with great horror, but of course I can't tell what you're thinking. I don't have magic powers. But yeah, I mean, I think all of us who love dogs, we're always looking at the dogs, aren't we, that we see in the street. We're looking to see if they're friendly, if they're going to come and say hello to us or not, if we're going to get to pet them or not, or if they prefer us not to. So I am always doing that, but I think every dog lover is always doing that anyway.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. So what dogs have you got now?
Now I have Pepper, who is a Shih Tzu, and he's 11. We adopted him last year, so he was 10 and he was very, very overweight when he came to us, so we had to put him on a diet. Now he's okay. He's not a very active senior, but he does consent to going on walks sometimes, and he's very sweet and quite cuddly. And he gets on really well with the cats, which is very nice. They don't quite cuddle up together, but one of the cats comes and she sits very, very close to him, and they're getting closer and closer and closer. So maybe eventually they will end up cuddling, but in any case, they get on well, and that's all you can ask for, really. I've got two cats. One is a tortoiseshell cat called Melina, and the other is a tabby cat called Harley. So they're both moggies. Harley has diabetes, but that's under control with insulin injections, which he's really good about. And they're both senior cats as well. So Harley is 13 now. So all our animals are seniors at the moment.
One of my favorite things about your writing, whether it's in the book or your positive posts or your companion animal psychology stuff, is that you are so very rooted in science, but you make it attainable to people without sensationalizing. And that's, you know, that can be a very fine line to walk. And I just I'm so happy that I have a place that I can send clients who don't want to read the scientific papers to your site and feel 100% secure that they're not getting information, misleading information, or information that's not rooted in science when they're searching for answers. So thank you for being so awesome.
Well, thank you. That's very high praise indeed. So thank you very, very much. I really appreciate you saying that. And I love writing about science, and I love talking about what it tells us and how it relates to, you know, the pets in our lives and how we train them, or how we should provide enrichment, for example. So for me, it's a lot of fun to be able to do that. And I think it's important because there are a lot of things that we think of as common sense, but other people may not think they're common sense. You know, some of the things that we're so used to doing when we're interacting with dogs, like even just using food to train, to other people, that's not necessarily common sense. So it is important that we have scientific research behind some of the things that we do, and it helps us to understand dogs better. And one of the things I just love about canine science so much is that it is so relevant to our everyday lives. There's so much of it that we can apply, and I think people really like to know about that. They like to know those things, you know, and so it's a privilege to be able to write about it and to have people enjoy it and read it and find it interesting.
Good
And they do.
So what
and
is
not,
the
just
go ahead, Sarah.
I was just, not to go too far down the rabbit hole of what takes hold and what people find logical or what makes sense, but that's partly why the pack theory kind of, you know, has got such a hold of people, because quite often to a lot of people that really does make sense, because they're equating dogs to wolves and how they think they work together. So it does make absolute sense, and it's one of those things now that's really, really entrenched and very, very difficult for people like us to get around. Not that you particularly need to tell someone that the, you know, no, but you know, you do need to find a way around it so that you can help them with training and what it is they're doing, particularly for us with the separation anxiety, because it's not about being the boss when it comes to learning how to leave your dog alone. So the more people that we have like you that have, you know, the websites and the books and everything that keep going down this scientific route, but without making it feel like you're being browbeaten or bashed because you're a bad owner or all these things, you know, the more information we can get out that feels good and that feels like you're doing something proactive and that you're learning, the better. So yeah, that's, you know, it's great that we do have these resources and that we're getting more and more as we go along.
And I think that's a great point about pack theory, because it kind of intuitively makes sense to a lot of people, because as you say, they're thinking about dogs as wolves and they're not thinking about the fact that dogs didn't evolve from modern day wolves. They evolved from whoever the ancestor of modern day wolves was as well. So they probably evolved from an animal that wasn't quite as fearful as modern day wolves are, because they've learned that they have to fear people. So that's quite different. And then also the way that dogs behave, they're not really pack animals in that way, but there's another metaphor that we can use for thinking about them, and that's as family. And I think it's much easier for people to understand when they're thinking about their dogs as family or even as a best friend, because unfortunately when you start talking about dogs as pack animals, somehow people, it brings out the worst in people and they start being wanting to be very punitive and boss them around, and you know, whereas when you're thinking about them as family or friends, then it's a much more nurturing relationship that comes to mind. And I think it's much better for people to think of their dogs in that kind of way.
Yeah, they're much more empathetic to what's going on with the dogs, aren't they, when they think of them that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Through your research and looking at others' research, what are the, I'm not going to say what's the one thing because that's always harder to answer, but what are some of the top things, pieces of information or misconceptions that that you feel like pet guardians should know?
Well, one of the things that... one of the things that I talk about a lot is just simply to train your dog with food, because there are still a lot of people who use mixed methods to train their dogs. Some of the time they use positive reinforcement and some of the time they use aversive methods. And we have an increasing body of research that tells us that, unfortunately, if people are using aversive methods, then there are risks to the dog's welfare, which you guys will all be familiar with. It's the risks of fear, anxiety, aggression, stress, potential health effects if it's long-term stress, risks of the person having a worse relationship with the dog, and maybe of the dog being pessimistic as well. And like the body of scientific research on this has only continued to grow over the years. So we keep seeing that there are these risks to using aversive methods, such as yelling at your dog, using a shock collar, using a choke chain, hitting your dog, just using a leash correction, or, you know, those times when people pull tight on the leash and only release it when the dog sits, that kind of thing. There are still a lot of people who use those methods, and it's really much, much better to use food to train your dog, because it works really well as positive reinforcement. You can, of course, use play or petting or something if you prefer, but often people think that praise will work, and there is actually some research that shows that praise doesn't really work very well unless it's always going to be followed by a piece of, like, something rewarding, like a piece of food. And it's very easy for people to learn to get in the habit of always having some kind of food around, treats around, that they can use to reward their dog. And so using food to train your dog is the most important thing. And if you're doing that, then you're, by definition, you're not using these other aversive methods. And one of the things I like to tell people, one of the scientific studies that I really like looked at how fast dogs will run to get different types of food. And they tested a piece of kibble compared to a piece of sausage, and the dogs will actually run faster to get a piece of sausage. So if you think, when you're telling someone, you know, how to train a dog to come when called, you always say, oh, well, you know, you need to use your best treats for recall because, you know, there are lots of other competing things and so on. But now science actually tells you that your dog will run to you faster if they know they're going to get a good reward that they really like as opposed to, say, just a piece of kibble or something.
And of course, who wouldn't? I mean, who wouldn't run faster for, you know, a tea sandwich versus a dry cracker? You know, I mean, I would.
Yeah, me too. Or a nice chocolate bar.
Exactly.
Yes. Definitely chocolate. Chocolate definitely gets me running. So one of the things that you mentioned and we talk about is welfare, animal welfare. So can you define that as you kind of think of it for us? Because WAG is all about the science of making your dog happy, right? So talks a lot about welfare. And so I just wanted to put a plug in for the book. If you haven't read it and you love your dog, you should read it. But in the book, you talk a lot about welfare. So can you define that for us about how you think of it?
Yeah, so WAG, the science of making your dog happy, is basically about the things that you need to know in order to make your dog happy. And of course, some things will be the same for all dogs and some things will be specific to your dog. And so I think when we're talking to ordinary people, it's easier to think about it as happiness, for example, rather than to just talk about good welfare. People maybe aren't so interested in good welfare. It doesn't sound as exciting. So I prefer to think of it as happiness. But one of the things that's important is trying to minimize the kinds of negative experiences that dogs might have or the negative things that people might have. And I think many people are used to hearing about the five freedoms of animal welfare, which have shaped how we think about welfare, not just for dogs, but for all kinds of animals since the 60s. And they were initially developed by the Farm Animal Welfare Council at a time when there was a lot of industrialization of farming and people were concerned about farm animals, cattle, for example, being in these big industrial barns and that kind of thing. But they've been absolutely fantastic and they've been instrumental in improving animal welfare around the world. But these days, there's also more of an emphasis on positive things happening. So it used to be that people thought about welfare as the absence of harm or the absence of bad things happening. And now we know that good animal welfare actually includes positive experiences as well. So there are kind of two reasons why we need to minimize the negative experiences. And one is simply because they're not very good in their own right. And the other is that if an animal, for example, is fearful or they're feeling pain or they've got separation anxiety and they've been left home alone, for example, they're not going to be able to take advantage of positive experiences that you give them because they're not going to feel like it. So you might give them some wonderful enrichment opportunity, but if they're in too much pain or they're too terrified because they're alone, they're not going to be able to take advantage of that. So we have to think about ways of providing positive experiences. And one of the ways that we know they've got good welfare is that they actually do feel able to take advantage of those enrichment opportunities that we're offering them, and they are using them and enjoying them, for example. And so WAG goes through everything from getting a puppy, taking your puppy to puppy class, training your dog, dogs and children, taking your dog for walks, enrichment, right through until the end of a dog's life, helping a senior dog, and thinking about those really difficult moments right at the very end. And every single chapter has a list of tips at the end of it to help you apply them to your own dog. And then right at the end of the book, there's a checklist for a happy dog, which I think people can use to help see things they're already doing, which they're getting right, which are great for their dog. So that's positive reinforcement to the people that they know what they're doing right. But there will inevitably also be some things on the list that you're not doing, and you can think about whether or not they would be helpful for your dog. Is this something that you want to integrate into your dog's life? Or of course not. I mean, it's up to you, but the checklist is there to help people to think about their dog's life and how they might be able to make them even happier than they already are. Because I think most of the people reading the book are going to be, by definition, good dog people who have happy dogs already.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that you bring up in the book that I think is really interesting and is a really big maybe shift or maybe not, but I think it's a shift, is I think, you know, it maybe previously when we thought of welfare, we're thinking, what does my dog need to survive? You know, nutrition, shelter, water, those types of things. And now I feel like when we're thinking about welfare, we're thinking about how can we facilitate this dog thriving. And I think that's a whole nother level of caring for our companion animals.
Yes, I think so. And I think increasingly as people do think about their dogs as family members, I think it's easy for them to see that they do actually want to help them to thrive rather than just to get by, you know, and be left out in the yard with some water and get given food. They want them to be part of the family, to be involved in, you know, the activities that are going on, and they want to make sure that they're doing really well. And I think that's a wonderful thing for dog welfare. I think it's really good that there are so many people wanting to know more about what they can do. And of course, it's better for the people too, because if your dog has what they need, then they're much less likely to have behavior problems. So they're less likely to develop them in the first place, or if they have existing behavior problems, to some extent, some of those problems can get better simply because you're providing a better environment and more enrichment and so on. Of course, not everything, but a lot of things will be better.
The shift into mental welfare for our animals, our companion animals, is huge. And I know it's, you know, it's still a tip of the iceberg compared to, you know, what we would love ideally. But when you think of some of the groups that are on Facebook now that, you know, where people look at enrichment, I mean, the canine enrichment group, I mean, it's got thousands and thousands of members now, and it's massive. It's taken off so ridiculously. Well, not ridiculous, no, it's marvellous. I mean, and the guy who runs it must be so happy that all of a sudden all these people are looking at enrichment. And for us, as people who deal with separation anxiety, I mean, that's historically and for quite a long time been one of those things that has been blamed on other things. You know, my dog's destructive, or my dog's being naughty, or they're, you know, having a tantrum because they don't want to get left in the room, not because they're suffering, but because they're just having a childlike tantrum. And that's being seen from that place of, again, kind of like almost like hierarchy, or seeing them in physical terms. You know, well, I've fed them, I've taken them out for a walk, and they've got a bed. What more do they want? You know, they should be happy. And we're thankfully moving away from that. So we're getting more, for us, we're getting more clients because people now want to address the separation anxiety. They want to know why the dogs are behaving like this and what they can do to help them in a physical and mental way to help their welfare and to give them longevity.
I mean, we really need people like you, because I mean, there are still others out there that don't trainers that don't re-educate themselves, and kind of, you know, they're still doing things they were doing 30, 40 years ago. But there's owners too that just don't have a clue, that are still, you know, or their friends and family are saying, oh, just chain the dog outside and just leave it, you know, let it bark it out, it's fine. It'll get over it. So the more people like you that are educating owners and trainers, just letting them know that there's a better way is it's really essential.
Thank you. Well, one of the things that we know when people do surveys of people and they ask them, where did you get your information about dog training? And there have been several different surveys that have overasked this question. And the most common answer seems to be, well, I got it from myself. And I think it's because so many people grow up with dogs, or at least even if they don't, they know lots of dogs as they're growing up. And so I think people think that they know about dogs. And I think even now, like if you're an adult, but you've had a dog as an adult before, and it's different when you're a child because someone else takes on most of the responsibility. But even if you've had a dog as an adult before, like if you've had them from a puppy and through their lives, there's so much happening in canine science that things have changed, you know, and it's worth knowing about, because it can help you to give your dog a better life. Even when it comes to like the sensitive period for socialization in puppies, I mean, we've known that's a thing for a very, very long time, but these days we have research that tells us that even more socialization done in a positive way, which doesn't stress the puppy out but encourages the puppy to interact with things, is really good for them. And we can look at that. There was some research from Guide Dogs for the Blind about extra socialization in the nest, and it showed benefits for the puppies as they were young adult dogs, so going forward. And we can point to that research and show how helpful it is. It's brilliant because it helps us to know how to treat dogs and what we can do to make their lives better. It's just fantastic.
And in terms of that socialisation, the more a puppy gets socialisation, there are studies saying that they're less likely to get separation anxiety if they're getting that confidence building out in the environment as well as in the home, obviously. But yeah, that if you can give them that, then that separation anxiety will be less likely.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's been more difficult through the pandemic because circumstances have at times changed so much that it's been very difficult to do that kind of socialization. And I'm sure you've been saying to people what they can do to help their dogs through this. You know, but I mean, people being at home and then suddenly going to work and then suddenly having to come back home and work from home again. There's been so much change. And I think that's been quite difficult for dogs as well as for people. So yeah, I think the more that we can do to help them, the better. And it's just so nice when we see a happy dog. There's nothing better than a happy dog. And it makes us happy too, I think, just to see.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think I seem to spend an awful lot of time at the minute explaining to people that the things that have happened over lockdown do have a big effect on the dogs, and that the effect on the dog things take longer with dogs than they do with us, don't they? So we can have a certain amount of where we're stuck inside, and then it doesn't take as long to get back around to going back out again and doing things. And then when things change, we go, oh, okay, and then we stay back at home again. Whereas for your dog, you can't explain that to them. So they've spent all this time with their owners at home, and then suddenly their owners are going out. The dog doesn't know why and falls apart. And then their owners are trying to do something about that, but they want it to happen in a very short space of time. And I think one of the more difficult aspects of helping people with separation anxiety, particularly during these times, is helping them understand that you need to add X amount of time onto everything you do with a dog compared to what you would do with your children or with other adults, we you know, human beings, because they work on a different timeline. And that's one of the things I think that I seem to spend an awful lot of time doing at the minute. I don't know about you two.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of COVID lockdown pups at the moment.
And the thing is that we can anticipate it. So we know that things are going to change, and we can be thinking, well, next week, maybe I'll be able to start going out and about again, or, oh no, next week I might have to start going out and about again, depending, you know, on your personal feelings about it. But your dog doesn't know that. They just know that all of a sudden everything has changed. And dogs like routine. Routines are good for pets because you know, they don't have control over very many things, and a routine helps them to know what's happening and feel more comfortable and safe and secure. So for everything to suddenly change, that's actually really quite difficult. I mean, if we didn't know it was coming, it would be harder for us too. But you're absolutely right. Dogs need all this extra time to get used to it.
And luckily, we talked about that last week in the podcast about how to.
We did.
Yeah, we did. So if you are having a listeners, if you are having some routine changes coming up, do have a listen to that episode for tips on how to make that transition a bit easier for your dog.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, having just moved a couple of months ago, I mean, my dogs, one of them's got noise phobia, so he was a problem, but the other two are quite robust. Even that, you know, it takes even that change of place had to be done with, you know, them in mind and how they're going to cope and how long is it going to take them to settle in and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it was but they're good now.
Yay. And it's amazing how when you get to the sort of like the level of doggydom that we're all in now, just how much your decisions are formed around them as well. That they would never have been formed. You know, I can think of lots of people who wouldn't think twice about the dogs or the cats before they move house or, you know, go on holiday, or, you know, they'll quite happily go on holiday for 3 weeks and leave the dog in kennels and things. And not that I'm saying that that's, you know, wrong by any means, but the length that I think that we go to. You were speaking earlier about how as doggy people, you know, we look at dogs when we're out and about to see if they're friendly, to see if anybody's going to come and say hello and see if we can go pet anybody and things like that. But we also, with knowledge also becomes that point where you can't unsee anything either. So when you do see things that are just a little bit out of kilter for you, you can't unsee it. And I've found that in some ways, going to like public parks or places, cafes where there's lots of dogs and things, I just can't go anymore. Because you can't, you know, you hear managers in restaurants saying, you know, please remove your dog because it's barking. Not mine, but somebody once when I went, and this manager was saying we only allow dogs that are well behaved. It's like, since when is a dog barking is not misbehaving, it's just communication. And you know, things like that once it's in your head, there's no shifting it, is there?
But I think it's one of those things that people are quite good at recognizing a happy dog, but they find it much more difficult to recognize those signs of stress. Mm. And they may look at a stressed dog quite often and think actually they're fine when they're not fine. And I think helping people to understand how to recognize that body language is a really useful skill. But you're right, then once you see it, you can't miss it. It becomes one of those things that's second nature. You notice the lower posture, you notice that the tail is completely tucked and the dog is looking the other way or something, you know, and you can't miss those signs once you know them. But a lot of people don't know them. And I think it's really good for them to learn how to recognize those signs. And it's part of being a good dog owner, really, especially if you have a dog that is fearful, like afraid of loud noises or something like that. It makes a big difference. But I'll say also, you talk about going to restaurants. We can't take dogs to restaurants here. And it's one of the things I really miss about England, being able to go to the pub and for a meal and take your dog and your dog sat under the table. It's a really lovely thing to be able to do. And unfortunately here, dogs are not allowed in restaurants. And we just now have a pilot scheme where they are allowed on some restaurant patios outside, but it's a really new thing. And I hope it continues, because it's so much nicer when you can take your dog places with you. And it's good for the dogs too.
Talking about the signs that dogs have, you know, that's one thing that as separation anxiety consultants that we really school our clients in is recognizing. Obviously, there's some obvious ones like a tucked tail. Most people kind of know, hopefully, that that's, you know, a dog that's having some issues. But, you know, the subtle ones as well, we really school our clients in those subtle signs that they know what might be leading into a full-blown panic attack. Yeah, so important.
I think that's awesome, because it really helps people to be able to recognize those signs. And I also think it's wonderful that there are people like you three who can help people when their dog has separation anxiety, because it's such a difficult thing for dog guardians to go through, especially if they, you know, they care why their dog is so upset. And it takes time. I think it's not something that's easy to solve on your own. It's really so much easier when you have a trained person who can help you to recognize those body language signs and know what to do and take you through it, and to actually be able to achieve a resolution, you know, and increase the amount of time that you can leave your dog for and they feel safe. It's so freeing, and it's so wonderful, and it gives you your life back, and it kind of makes your dog happy again. So I think it's brilliant that there is, you know, this kind of help available for people now when they didn't used to be. And I think that's another way in which life for dogs has changed for the better. I mean, not everything has changed, you know, not everything is wonderful, but that is one of the ways in which dogs' lives have got better.
Dogs' lives have changed a lot. When you think, like, 50 years ago, they were, you know, they were just running around the street. They weren't in enclosed yards, and they were, like, you know, off doing their own thing all day and then coming home and they knew it was dinner time and time for, you know, bed or whatever. But and then suddenly things have changed so much for them. You know, they're in the house more, they're not roaming the streets the way they might have used to have done. So in that respect, things have changed. And then we've had to also then change the way we are with them in terms of ensuring that they feel safe at home when we're not there and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I remember an aunt and uncle of mine years ago when I was younger, they had a border collie, and as a treat, it was allowed to put its paws across the threshold into the house, out of the kitchen. That, you know, that was it. It could put its feet in the hallway, but it spent its entire life in the kitchen or out and about, but it never went in the rest of the house.
Wow.
And even as a child, I think I must have been about 8 or 9, I remember. I mean, I never forget it, obviously, it's still with me all these years later. But even as a child, I remember thinking, why is he not in on the sofa? Why are you not cuddling him?
Yeah, my dad was dogs are outside. We had a black Labrador. He slept in the laundry, but he wasn't allowed in the house. And I could never understand that. made me sad. Part of the family.
Yeah, and I think it's been a really good change for dogs. I mean, the danger is that sometimes people anthropomorphize too much and they put human feelings onto dogs too much. But overall, I think the balance is much, much better that dogs get to be an active part of our lives and part of the family more. It's just lovely, isn't it? It's nice. Wouldn't really want to be without a dog. We had to be without a dog for a while after Bodger passed, and with it being the pandemic, it was very, very difficult to find a dog. But also we needed time to grieve Bodger after he'd gone, because he'd been such an important part of our lives for so long. And so we had to wait a while, and then it took us a long time to find a dog. But it was kind of, it's not the same. Life without a dog is not the same.
I can never imagine with not listening to those little patty paws trundling around, following, you know, wandering around with, you know, coming to see what you're doing in the kitchen, because of course they're always there when you're in the kitchen. Yes, I couldn't imagine life without it either.
It's interesting because Rowan, my dog, was at the vet for a day getting some x-rays done, and I was surprised at how lonely I felt. Like, even, no, I mean, seriously, you don't, even when you're not interacting, it's just having them there in the house with you, like, makes you feel less alone, I guess. It was interesting to me how much I missed him. You know, even though we went for our morning walk like we always do, and then, you know, when he got home, we spent time snuggling. He's not a big snuggler, but he was still a little bit drunk from the meds, so he wanted to snuggle, which was fabulous. Definitely took advantage of it.
When's Purr out and about for the general public to peruse, Zazie?
Purr is coming out on May the 3rd in Canada and the US, and on May the 5th in England, the UK. And the only reason for that is that in this part of the world, books come out on Tuesdays, and in the UK, they come out on Thursdays. I have no idea why. That's just how it is. So anyway, early May. Yeah.
And in Australia, do you know?
I would think around the same time, but I'm not actually sure, I'm afraid. But it will be, it's going to be a hardback, and also as an audiobook as well, and a Kindle electronic version. So whichever version of books you prefer, you've got the full choice. So, and they're recording the audiobook very soon, which is quite exciting.
Cats are fascinating, I think. Like, I used to... it's kind of not study them, but, you know, I used to buy books when I was a kid on cat behavior and what cats doing, you know, if they're, you know, blinking their eyes at you and all that sort of stuff. They're interesting creatures.
Yeah, I mean, cats are just lovely. I think one of the things with cats is that they, to some extent, do not get as much attention as dogs do, and people think of them as not needing as much as dogs do. But especially for people who have an indoor cat, because in some places, like in North America, most cats are indoors, unlike in the UK where it's still quite common, and Europe where it's very common for cats to be allowed outdoors. If your cat is indoors only, then actually they do need quite a lot of activities and enrichment and things to do, because it's a very boring environment for them. It doesn't really change much from day to day. So, I mean, my cats are both indoors only because we live in an area where I don't think it would be safe for them to go outside. We've got coyotes and cougars and bobcats and so on. So I don't think bears would threaten the cats, but certainly it upsets the cat if they see a bear through the window. So, you know, we keep them indoors. But it does mean that you have to do more for them. You do need to make time to play with them. You do need to, you know, use food puzzle toys and make sure that they have things that change in the environment, and also that they can come and spend time with you as well. Like, I have my cats shut out of the room at the moment because I didn't want them to come and sit in front of the camera and walk all over my keyboard and things, which is what they tend to do when I'm trying to work. But, you know, they need that time with us. If they're the kind of cat that's used to spending time with people, then they need to be able to spend time with their people as well. So I think it's good for people to learn that cats do actually probably need a bit more, and if you put a bit more into your relationship with your cat, then it's really going to be beneficial for both of you.
I have a client, shout out to Georgie, Katie and Buffy's a little dashy, but they've got a cat as well, and when I'm doing that, they send me videos of their training, and the cat is always part of the training. It follows them to the door and it's hanging around and, you know, just wants to be on the camera all the time. They don't think it's got separation anxiety, but I'm like, that cat is following you to the door all the time. So funny.
Yeah, and like if I'm training Pepper, one of my cats, Melina, is always hanging around, like, because she's hoping that she'll get a treat as well, basically. Yeah. So she's always there, like, is there something for me?
So we had a, it's interesting to me because we used to have three cats and we have one dog, and the relationship the cat and the dog had really depended so much on the cat and their comfort level with dogs. And so it was really validating, I guess, to read about that study where that was one of the kind of driving points in how well cats and dogs get along, is how comfortable the cat is with dogs. But one of our cats was just like, Milena, your cat, in that, you know, if I'm ever teaching Rowan something, he was always right there. And I would teach him the same stuff because, you know, he seemed to enjoy it and he definitely enjoyed the treats involved. So, you know, it's interesting because I have somewhere recently, I was listening to a podcast and I forget what it was, but they were saying something about how you can't train cats. And I was like,
that's rubbish.
What?
Nah, of course you can train cats.
Yeah, not true. Same learning theory applies.
Absolutely. But, yeah. And of course you can train cats, and cats being trained, it can be a fun enrichment activity for you as well. I would say one of the most important things to train a cat, though, is to teach them to go in their cat carrier, because so many people have trouble getting their cat to the vet because they can't even get them in the carrier. So at the end of PER, I've got a plan to teach your cat to go in their carrier, and then I've also got a plan to teach your cat to sit pretty, just so that there's a fun trick that people can teach their cat if they want to. And that's based on a plan that I used. I taught Melina to sit up and sit pretty. So now I'm teaching Pepper to do that. But I taught Melina to do that, you know, some years ago. And I think it's really fun to train a cat. I mean, you have to train in shorter amounts of time. Depending on the cat, you might have to be a bit careful if they're a bit bitey. This applies to both of my cats. They're a bit bitey. They don't have the same level of experience of taking treats from your hand as dogs would. So they didn't learn as kittens to come and take treats nicely. So if you have a treat in your hand, it's kind of, it can feel a bit dangerous. So sometimes when you're training your cat, it's easier to put the treat on something, or to use a spoon, or to use a wet treat and let them lick it from the top of the tube. And then it's a bit safer for you. And also, I find that training is often interrupted by the cat coming and rubbing themselves. Like Melina, she'll come and rub herself on me, like she'll rub her head on me. But just because that's what cats do, that it's one of their affiliative behaviors. And it's a good sign. It shows that they're having a nice time and they like you, basically. But so, yeah, just train them in small amounts. And it's really fun. Training a cat is really fun.
Yeah. So what about cats and separation anxiety?
Yeah, so I do have a very short section on cats and separation anxiety in the book, because I've got a chapter on behavior issues that you might have. And there was a study done in Brazil that really was looking at whether or not cats can have separation anxiety, and they concluded that they can, and that some of the signs would be similar to the signs that you would see in dogs. So when the guardian is out, the cat would pee or poop in inappropriate places. They would meow a lot or make a lot of noise. They might be destructive with things, and they maybe would groom themselves too much. But they came to the conclusion that these were signs of separation anxiety or separation related issues. But of course, with a cat, like with a dog, you have to consider whether there are other things going on as well. So you would want to take your cat to the vet. If they're peeing and pooping in the house when you're out, you need to check that that's not a medical issue. So you would need to take your cat to the vet and get them checked out there. And of course, boredom is quite a big issue, especially for indoor cats. So if they're being destructive when you're out, it's possible that they're actually just bored. It's not necessarily that they're upset at being separated from you. Yeah. So I think that's very similar to dogs. But this study also found some of the things related to those behaviours happening when the guardian was out was to do with the cat not having any toys, there being no other pets in the home, and the cat being left home alone for long periods of time. And so without a bit more research, you don't know to what extent it is just that these cats are bored or there's something else going on. So I think if anyone thinks their cat might have separation related issues, it is important to get them checked out at the vet and to think about it and to seek help from the vet as well. And the other thing, of course, about cats as a species is that they're very good at being on their own. Many cats are very, very good at being on their own. Some cats live entirely on their own without any help from humans at all. So it does depend also on the extent to which the cat was socialized as a kitten, if they've been well socialized as a kitten during that sensitive period and they've got to know lots of or multiple other people in that time, then they're going to be friendly and able to bond with people. But of course, some cats, they never make that bond, or they only make that bond with one particular person and they're not so much bothered about others. So I think there's probably a lot of variation in cats, perhaps more so than dogs, but it's a great question. And I hope it's something that we're going to see more research into, especially with the pandemic and cats having to get used to their routines changing, just like we talked about dogs having to get used to it. It's a big deal for cats too. I think routines are really important for cats. Some cats will have been unhappy that they had people home more interfering with their snoozing time, you know. whereas other cats will have been very pleased to have their family around more, depending, you know, on the relationship with all of the people. So there's probably a lot of variety there as well.
Be interesting.
Isn't the sensitive period for cats earlier than for dogs?
Yes, that's right. It is earlier than for dogs. So for dogs, it's from 3 until about 12 to 14 weeks, and we don't know exactly when it ends. And for kittens, it's between 2 and about the end of 7 weeks. But again, it's not an exact cutoff at the end, and that's why we call it a sensitive period now rather than a critical period, because in the past, we used to think that animals absolutely had to have these experiences in this time. Exactly this time frame, and now there's a bit of, we don't know exactly about the cutoff at the end. The adolescent brain is still developing as well, but yeah, so it's earlier for cats, and that means kittens go through this period before they go to their new home, because typically some go to their new home at 8 weeks and some it would be more like 12 to 14 weeks, especially for a pedigree cat. It's going to be more like 12 to 14 weeks when they go to their new home. So those early experiences all are going to happen at the home in which they're bred, and that's why you really want to make sure that they're in a home, in the same way that you would with a puppy. You want to make sure that they're being raised in a home, not out in a barn somewhere, so that they're in the home being exposed to normal household noises and having people around and things, because that will help to set them up to be friendly and confident adult cats, or with puppies, adult dogs. But yes, so it's an earlier period, and that means it's all happened before the kitten comes to you, but still, when you have your kitten, you want to be building on that socialization as much as you can. So you still want to be trying to give your kitten positive experiences and encouraging them to interact with different household objects and different people. And in some places, vets have kitten kindy classes where you can go take your kitten to a kitten kindergarten. I think this is a big thing in Australia because this was started by an Australian veterinary behaviorist called Dr. Kirsty Sexel, who's in Sydney Animal Behavior Services, and she had this idea of kitten kindergarten, which as a vet, several vets offices run these things now around the world. So if you're lucky and you have a vet who does it, then you can bring your kitten into this class and help to get them some increased exposure and learn a bit more about cat and kitten behavior, and also if it's at the vet, then it's helping get them used to the vet as well.
I would so love to run one of those.
Oh, maybe you should.
Oh, little kittens. Oh, okay. I used to have cats. I do miss not having cats, but where we are now is one of those places. It's a very a road that gets a lot of HGVs on it, and it just wouldn't be a good place. But I do miss having kitty cats wandering around, and you can't beat kittens, can you? I mean, they're just ridiculous.
I know, they're so much fun.
Adorable. I know. And I was watching a video today of a couple who live on a canal boat, and they've got two cats, and every time they stopped, the cats got off. off the boat, and had a wander around the canal banks and went and pounced about in the local fields, and they looked like they're having an absolute ball. I didn't think that you could do that with a cat, but, you know, I was always told that if you moved out, you had to keep them in for weeks and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But they clearly know where their boat is, and come back every time. There's no, you know, they've been on the boat for years. It's so fascinating.
That's brilliant. And they must be quite special cats, because, like you say, if normally if you move house with a cat, you're going to want to keep them in for a few weeks to make sure that, you know, they're not going to run away or try and get back to where they used to live, because cats are quite territorial. So these cats must have got used to it as kittens, perhaps, and that would really help. But also these days you see some people with, they call them adventure cats, taking their cats out on hikes on a harness and things like that, which didn't used to happen. And again, if you're starting to get your cat used to that as a kitten, I think it's much easier to do that kind of thing and get them used to that kind of thing. Some cats would absolutely hate it. Mine would not like it. One of my cats, although we got him from the SPCA, we were told that he'd never been outside even before he came to us. He'd lived in an apartment, never been outside, so he would be, I think, quite terrified outside. So it depends on the cats, but, you know, you get so much variation. But I think that's a fantastic life for a cat if they like doing those things and they're able to go out and roam.
Especially all those fields and things.
My Pinky used to go next door, this is before he became a prisoner in the house, and go through their doggy door, beat their dog up and eat all the food that was available. They weren't impressed. They actually threatened his life, and we're like, oh yeah, we're gonna have to keep him inside from now on, because we don't know what they're gonna do to him.
When I lived in Nottingham, so this is going back a long way, we had two cats then, but one of the neighbor's cats used to come in the cat flap, and one time I woke up in the middle of the night and there was all this caterwauling coming from the landing, and the neighbor's cat had actually come in and up the stairs and was fighting, my cats were trying to fight it away. So we had to change the cat flap to a microchip one so that other cats couldn't come in. I mean if you have cats that are going outside, you can sometimes get quite a bit of conflict between neighboring cats, and you can also find that cats will often actually timeshare, like they'll have their own time when they go out into a garden, when they know that other cats won't be there, and then they'll come back in again, and then some other cat will go because they know that there's no other cats going to be there, so they'll timeshare with the space so that they don't have to meet each other, and it helps to cut down on conflict. But even if your cats are indoors only, like, that sometimes they can be quite upset if they see another cat go by. They're not necessarily sociable in the same way as dogs. Like, we like to think that dogs are going to be sociable with other dogs, but for many cats they're actually not terribly bothered about other cats around. So cats in a multi-cat home, often they will get used to each other. It helps if they're the kind of cat that's used to having other cats around, but for some people with cats in a multi-cat home, they're not necessarily actually part of the same group, and there can sometimes be conflict between those cats, which can be quite difficult to manage. But that's a long way from separation anxiety, I think.
Are you going to do any more dog books?
Well, I don't know at this point in time. The thing about being an author is that everything depends on how well your last book did. So I have something. I would like to write another dog book, but it will depend on getting a contract for it, and probably that will depend on Purr doing well. So if you want me to do another dog book, please go out, even if you're not a cat person, maybe go buy Purr for a friend or something. Because you need a book to do well. And I've been incredibly lucky, because WAG launched it was the 10th of March in 2020. It was right at the start of all the lockdowns. Even in the run-up to it coming out, there was a lot of talk, obviously, about what was going on, and there was a lot of publicity arranged that was in person, so obviously that all got cancelled. And I've been incredibly lucky that, thanks to all the people who support me and support Companion Animal Psychology, I'm so grateful to those people, because they helped to spread the word about the book and tell people about it. And despite when it launched, WAG has actually done done very well, and I'm really grateful to. So thank you, everyone listening. If you supported me, I really, really appreciate it. It has made a big difference. And because of that, I was able to write Purr, which is the cat version. And hopefully Purr will do well too, because I think there are definitely lots of people who love their cat very much and want to be able to give their cat a better life and help to make sure that their cat is happy and also just understand their cat better. And fingers crossed I'll get to write another book about dogs after that, but we have to wait and see. it's a bit of a tease, but I don't know.
Well, we'll keep fingers crossed. My hairdresser fosters kittens for a local rescue. She's been doing it, I think it's about a year now. So she's just constantly got kittens after kittens after kittens. So I did mention that you were bringing a book out. So maybe I'll buy it for her when she comes and cuts my hair next, when it comes out in May, as a thank you gift for haircut.
Thank you.
Well, it's important, particularly if you're fostering or if you're doing something like that. I think it's important that you know as much as you can, really, isn't it? Because you're there at the front line with all these tiny little babies who are often ill or they've had no sort of social aspect at all anywhere. So it's I think it'd be a nice book for her.
Thank you. Yeah, and that's incredibly important, the work that she's doing fostering those kittens, because we talked about the sensitive period and how important it is for kittens to have lots of good experiences. And if kittens have come from a more difficult background, it's even more important for them to have that. So she's giving those kittens a fantastic start in life, so that's great. And thank you very much to everyone who's bought Wagon is going to pre-order Purr. That I really, really appreciate it.
Oh, and she's got a massive German Shepherd as well, so when they leave, they're kind of like, they don't mind big German Shepherds, and he's very sweet with them.
Oh, fantastic. Apart from,
but they're not allowed in his bed.
That's funny. And you know, Stacey mentioned earlier that there was a study about how dogs and cats get on, and the most important thing was that the cat was comfortable in the presence of the dog. And one of the things that study found was that often in those cases, the cat would share the dog's bed, the dog would let the cat share their bed, and that can often be a sign that, you know, that they are comfortable together. The cats do not share their bed with the dogs, so that's the other way around. With the German Shepherd. But cat beds are quite small, and cats also prefer them to be high up, which is kind of hard for a dog to get to, so I think that's fair enough.
Yeah, my cat used to get in my dog's bed, and she was only tiny. She was quite a tiny cat, and we had a big dog bed because we had a big dog. And she used to be right in the middle of it, and my poor dog used to wander around going, she's in my bed again. We're like, what? Well, so I could tell her to get out. We're like, no. Yeah.
That is so Rowan. He'll like be whining, you know, and then I'll look and she's either in his bed but he won't go in the bed if she's in the bed, you know, like it's
all stood. Stood halfway up the stairs, that's the other one, isn't it? The cat halfway up the stairs.
Yes.
With the dog. Wanted to, the dog going, no.
Yes, no one can go past then.
Yeah, yes. You will not pass.
You shall not pass. Exactly. Exactly. That's funny. So Zazie, where can people find you if they are looking to learn more about what you do, or well, also you should talk about the positive post, because that's a subscription based thing that if people are hungry for the science part of it, would be really interested in that.
Yeah, so the positive post is my premium newsletter, which means that people have to pay for it, and it gives people more information about the science of dog and cat behavior. And it, as well as the newsletter, we also have regular events, including webinars, and we're starting a journal club for people who want to be able to talk about a journal article in a friendly environment. You don't have to have any kind of science background to be able to take part in that. And the positive post itself goes out twice a month on the first and third Wednesday, and it's packed with information about dogs and cats. And also there's a column from my colleague Christy Benson, who sometimes writes for Companion Animal Psychology as well. So if you want to know about that or about my blog, companionanimalpsychology.com is the place to go. And my free Companion Animal Psychology newsletter goes out typically once a week with my blog post for that week, and usually a bit of other information as well. And also, if you want to know more about my books, they're available from all good bookstores, but you can also find those links on my website as well. So companionanimalpsychology.com is where you'll find everything about me and my social media if you want to follow me there as well.
Fabulous. Good.
And we'll put all those links on the show notes as well, so if anybody missed that, they'll be able to find them afterwards when they have a look.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. It's been awesome talking to you.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's been a real pleasure to chat with you. And thank you also for all that you do to help people to understand about separation anxiety in dogs, because it's such a big deal and you make such a big difference to people. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And it's so nice to have another Yorkshire person on the blog. We're not on a blog, podcast.
Podcast. I know. I'm feeling homesick now.
As you notice, though, the accent's not quite as strong as mine, but hey ho.
Yeah, because I've moved around so much, I kind of lost bits of mine, but I think I do still sound British rather than Canadian. So
definitely.
But you can tell I've moved around, so I don't have that strong Yorkshire accent anymore.
No, it's gone. And not only is Zazie from Yorkshire and from Leeds, she's even from the same suburb of Leeds where I'm from as well. So it's not just a similar town, you know. Well, it's like,
yeah, it's a very small world. And not only that, but Sarah also lives very near my sister as well, so that's you know, even smaller, so very nice.
You know, I've been looking for Yorkshire puddings in the supermarket. I used to be able to buy them over here, and I don't know what's going on. I can't buy them. I'm certainly not going to make them, but I just thought I'd share that with you. Yorkshire puddings, you can buy them in the freezer section of the supermarket, except you can't right now for months and months and months.
Oh, I'm so devastated. You'll have to make them. No. You know, they're not so hard to make once you get the hang of it. it's practice and making sure that the oven tray is really, really hot and the oven is really, really hot, and then they turn out good. So, like, I think it's one of those things everyone worries about, but with a bit of practice you can show off about making good ones.
Sarah doesn't look like she agrees with you.
I can't make them. I mine turn out, as we call mine, Yorkshire biscuits, because they do not come out looking like they should. It's too warm anyway for Ness to be making Yorkshire puddings right now. Maybe they'll be back when it gets colder.
Maybe in the winter. Yeah.
Or maybe they'll be back in the supermarket by then.
Yeah. Just don't ask me how to do it. Maybe we'll get Zazie back and she can give you a lesson.
Cooking for Zazie.
Yeah, just not me. So thank you for listening to another episode of Tales from the Doghouse, Separation Anxiety Explained. I hope that you enjoy this podcast as much as we have, and I'm sure you'll all agree that Zazie was a fabulous guest and we've all learned so much from her. And I can say, go out and buy those books. So if you've not got Wag, go get it. And if you've obviously you've not got Perk, it's not out yet, but it'll be out in May, so go and pre-order it, and we'll make Zazie lots of book money so she can make another book about dogs. Okay. You've been listening to me, Sarah McLaren, from the UK, from Separation Anxiety Solutions. You can find me on Facebook and on Instagram, and my website is separationanxietysolutions.com.
And I am Stacey Bell in the US with Focused Fun. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Focused Fun Dogs, and my website is focusedfun.net.
And I'm Ness Jones. I am in Australia. I'm from Separation Anxiety in Dogs Decoded, and you can find me in all the usual places. If you like our podcast, please share it with your friends. Give us a 5-star review. You can find us on all good listening platforms, and we will be back next week. Bye.
Woo! Bye. Thanks again, Zazie.
Say bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.